Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Let me begin. I have you can, if those who want, you can always send a private text to me. So I have one that one of you points out that last week question was raised about a statement about Hirsch about rabbi doctors, and the quote is, when rabbis become doctors, Judaism is sick. And I've heard that as well, but I don't know if it's actually true, because Hirsch actually had no problem with rabbis being doctors, PhDs, or any sort of that. On the contrary, members of his family and his followers routinely became doctors. He did not, which is quite unusual, but in the Frankfurt community, they were just as much Rabbiner doctors as in Berlin. The difference was that in Frankfurt, they did not get doctorates in academic Jewish studies. In Berlin, basically everyone did. But in Frankfurt, they literature, philosophy, things like that, they did not believe in academic Jewish studies. A couple things before we start. I don't know how many of you get the Jewish Review of Books. The new issue came on Friday. Oh, there you go. Yisrael points out the son-in-law of Hirsch, Shlomo Breuer. But they all were doctors. If the Reform rabbis were doctors, then the Orthodox rabbis also had to be doctors in Germany. So in the Jewish Review of Books, you have an article here, a translation by an essay. I believe it actually it might not be a translation. No, it's original English. It's called A Stone for a Slingshot by Ben Hecht. And Ben Hecht was together with Hillel Cook, who Hillel Cook was the nephew of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, but better known as Peter Bergson. They were two people who were very involved in organizing, awareness. They did an enormous amount for organized awareness of what was going on during the Holocaust. If any of you have seen the movie put out about America and the Holocaust, that was on PBS a number of years ago, I actually have a tape of it. They were involved in everything from the Rabbi March to this these shows that they put on. They put on a big one in Madison Square Garden. It went around the whole country raising awareness of what was going on during the Holocaust. Let me read you something that Ben Hecht, who was a playwright, he also was famous for writing Perfidy, which is an attack on the mainstream labor Zionists. The Nechari Karta likes to reprint Perfidy, but he writes as follows in May 1947. The letter is addressed to, quote, the terrorists of Palestine. And listen to this, because we spoke about the Irgun. My brave friends, the Jews of America are for you. You are their champions. You are the grin they wear. You are the feathers in their hat. Every time you blow up a British arsenal, or wreck a British jail, or send a British railroad train sky high, or rob a British bank, or let go with your guns and bombs at the British betrayers and invaders of your homeland, the Jews of America make a little holiday in their hearts. Then he goes on to say, not all the Jews of America, not the rich, fancy Jews, but the real Jews. As I said already, if you want to find out the halachic implications of that sort of terrorism, you would have to ask a rabbi, not Ben Hecht. But it goes to show you that, the sentiment among right-wing spokesmen for Zionism. The next thing before we start is that I just want to bring you back for a minute to, I can't find it here, but I'll tell you outside. If you recall our Rav Zevin lectures, well, I received an email from Norman Stillman. I don't know if any of you know the name. If you read the Sfarim blog, you would have seen the post that he put on it. He is a professor emeritus of Spanish Jewish history. Really, that's his field. Medieval Spain has written a number of books on this, including an encyclopedia of Spanish Jewish converso writers. He sent me, and I had no idea, I never met him, I still haven't met him, although now we've had lots of communications. He was at Wisconsin, he still lives in Wisconsin. He was a professor for many years at the University of Wisconsin. So you know the name, and I see that he's a scholar of Jewish history in Spain, and truthfully, he's well known at the Harvard program that I was at, because he wrote a very negative review of Isidore Torsky's Introduction to the Code of Maimonides. But he emails me that he was perhaps the only student of Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, other than the grandson. Now, again, what I said is I had no idea that he ever went to yeshiva. I don't know him. I had no concept. You know, sometimes you meet these people or you contact them, and then you learn that they're not just academics, but he, you know, has a yeshiva background. He went in the 50s to Merkaz Harav, and from there he transferred to Kamenetz, the Rosh Yeshiva, which his name is Rav Yitzhak Shiner, who I'm going to do something about him on the Sfarim blog as well, because in all the Haredi biographies about him, all they talk about is how he went to Israel, became close to the Brisker Rav. They never mention, and they give a whole biography. He's from Pittsburgh and all this. They never mention that he went to Yeshiva College. That they cut out. And in fact, Stillman's another scholar, Norman Roth. He says to me that in those days, Rav Shiner is not like today. He's known as an extremist. Of all these Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, he's the only one who could read English. So he's the only one that read Slifkin's books, and it was based on his testimony that it was put in Cheirim. So Roth said, but in those days he was hardly an extremist. The yeshiva was full of Mizrahi types. But then he starts telling me stories about Rav Zevin, including the fact, and this I never would have imagined, that Rav Zevin had the New York Times sent to him from America, and he would read the New York Times. I didn't even know he read English. And Professor Roth actually used to have Shabbos meals with him because Rav Zevin didn't have a yeshiva, didn't have anything. He just was working in the Talmudic Encyclopedia. So he had this one student, Norman Roth, and I'm hoping, I mentioned it to him, that he should write up a memoir and we could post it as well. Other than that, let us begin, because I do want to finish up with Rav Reuven Katz today. Hopefully I will. And I want to start with something I said at the end of last class, because it wasn't entirely accurate. I looked into it. We got further last class than I thought, and I relied on something that appears in the hagiography of Rav Reuven Katz called Rabash al Ema Moshavot. That's Petach Tikva. It's the first of the Jewish settlements outside the old settlements of like Jerusalem, Tiberias, Tzfat, and Hebron. So I want to return, because it is, when I spoke about Rochanan Wasserman is explosive enough as it is, what I'm going to tell you. I don't need to make it more explosive. And what I said last time, although it appears in the hagiography, and the hagiography is hardly a religious Zionist text, but I don't think it's accurate, and I'll explain to you why. So let's pick up exactly where we were last time. If you recall, I mentioned that there was this dispute over what they called Avodah Ivrit. Now, there were unemployed Jews in the land of Israel, and yet there were Arabs also unemployed, and you had Jews who were hiring Arabs because the Arabs were cheaper. And many people spoke out against this, including Rav Reuven Katz. He writes an article against this. Rav Chanan Wasserman, in 1934, sends a letter to Poalei Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael has this element to it, which is the Workers' Party. They always had a difficult relationship with the Aguda per se, and eventually they end up breaking with them, so much so that in Israel, the Aguda actually runs on a separate ticket in the 1950s, and the response of the Haredim, if you think the response of the Haredim is harsh now, they basically put them in all in Cheirim. And these were Haredi people, but they were workers, they were socialist inclined, and when they decided not to go along with the instructions of the Gedolim, and they had their own rabbis, the response was unbelievably harsh, just like you're seeing today. They're called the traitors, the worst things you can imagine. But in 1934, they still were part of Agudas Yisrael, and Rabbi Chanan Wasserman sends a letter to them. And this was published in the Aguda paper Kol Yisrael. The Aguda paper Kol Yisrael, we've spoken about before, was an extremist paper. It's not like an Aguda paper you might think of in Vilna or Warsaw. This was the paper identified with the ultra-extremists, the Eda Haredit, in Jerusalem. And in this letter, he says as follows. He says a couple things. One is that the Poalei Agudas Yisrael should not cooperate with the regular Zionists. There was all this, you know, there was a Histadrut, and there was talk that all workers should unite because workers have an interest. He said they should not cooperate with the Zionists when it comes to Avodah Ivrit. And he says also there's no reason not to hire Arabs as employees over Jews, even if the difference in salary is small. So he says when it comes to Arabs and Jews, and this is referring to all Jews, religious Jews, non-religious Jews, there's no obligation to hire a Jew, even if there's a difference in salary that you pay more to the Jew, even if this amount is small. And then he says, and this is where it gets tricky, and this is the controversial part, and I want to be exact, because I looked it up. I have here the Kovetz Ma'amarim, the collected letters and articles of Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. What he says is, when it comes to religious Jews, there's no obligation to pay more for a religious Jew when you can get an Arab. And then he says, when it comes to the non-religious Jews, there is no obligation at all to hire them in place of Arabs. In other words, even if they cost the same amount, there is no obligation to hire the non-religious Jew if you have an Arab and a non-religious Jew. With a religious Jew and an Arab, if the cost is the same, you obviously have to hire the Jew. Now, what I said last class, and this comes right out of page 29 of the hagiography, is that Rabbi Yochanan says if it's a choice between non-religious Jews and Arabs, you should hire the Arabs. Of course, it's going to be a difficult thing for us to hear. But as I just mentioned, what we're going to hear, or we are hearing, is difficult enough as it is. We don't need to add to it. I looked in the book, and I read the essay very carefully, and I do not see where it says that you should prefer Arabs over non-religious Jews. What he says is as follows. One, that you, and this is maybe where they derive it from, you can't have any involvement with the non-religious or join together with them in an organization. But that doesn't mean that you should prefer to hire an Arab instead of a non-religious Jew. What he says is that when it comes to hiring, the Arab and the non-religious Jew are equal. He says you have no obligations and you have no feelings of brotherhood when it comes, no halakhic obligations of brotherhood when it comes to a non-religious Jew. And therefore, the Arab and the non-religious Jew are the equivalent. And therefore, it doesn't matter, my conclusion is, who you hire. But he doesn't say that you should prefer the Arab. He simply says that they're equivalent. And as I said, I think that's hard enough for us to hear. And, I'm going to have to take a look at the Art Scroll biography of, I made a note to do that. Because if you've been following my posts, I've been showing you how in the English translations, they cut out the difficult things that are difficult for English speakers to hear. I'm curious as to whether in the Hebrew, well, first I have to see if in Sorsky's biography of Rabbi Yochanan, he actually mentions this. And then I want to see if in the English they leave it in. We've had this before in this class. I pointed out things about the Sipor, which will not appear in the English translation. So Rabbi Yochanan, as far as I can read it, and I can send it to anyone who's interested, he never says that if you have an Arab and a non-religious Jew, you should prefer the Arab. He simply says that there's no, you have no connection to him at all, that is the Jew. You have no feelings of brotherhood. Let me read you exactly his words here. He says about non-religious Jews, they are not considered Yatsu Mikol Amitecha, they're not considered your brethren. Asher al pitor hakdosha, Elohim shum yitron al nachrim. They have no advantage over Gentiles. But he doesn't say, at least as I see it, that the non-Jews have an advantage over the Jews. When he says that you want to keep away from the non-religious, he's referring to in an organizational sense. In any event, as I said, it's very hard for us to, I think, for people to hear this, that he's saying that when comes to an Arab, you can hire an Arab over a Jew, even if the cost is the same. Now, Rav Reuven Katz was astounded by this, outraged, and he wrote to Rav Chaim Moser Grzynski. This created somewhat of a storm, because Rav Yochanan was known as an important Aguda figure, and Rav Chaim Moser writes back to Rav Reuven, and we have Rav Chaim Moser's letter. I'll read you a minute in a second, and he says, first of all, he says, I don't know why my brother-in-law, Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman's his brother, while is involving himself in this matter. He lives in Europe, so what does he have to do with what's going on in Eretz Yisrael? And apparently, I don't see any evidence that anyone ever asked him this question. He wrote to them, and even if someone had asked him, he shouldn't have intervened. This has nothing to do with him. He's in Europe. This is going on in the land of Israel. And there are great rabbis in the land of Israel who will decide matters like this? We also know that the Chazon Ish disagrees with Rav Yochanan Wasserman. Now, in the letters of Rabbi Chaim Ozer on volume 3, beginning on page 276, you see his response, where he says, the letter to Rav Reuven Katz, like I just mentioned, I'm very shocked. Why would he do this? He also tells us that Rav Yochanan's letter was printed in special booklets, maybe the Neturei Karta types printed it up, and it was hung up in synagogues and Batei Medrash. And he says, I don't know why he would do this, to publish his personal opinion. B'li hit yashvut. I think b'li hit yashvut means without considering the matter in any depth, without really analyzing it. And he says, I knew nothing about it. And the Gam Hifrizal Amide says, Rav Yochanan Wasserman is exaggerating here in what he says. And this is very vital words. He says, Ein inyane hayishu bartzeno kdosha domim le'inyanim pratim begola mikamatamim. He says, and matters of the yeshuv in the land of Israel are not connected. You know, they don't have the same concerns to what goes on in diaspora. If you're in a town in Poland and you have a Jew and you have a non-Jew and you're going to say, well, the non-Jew is a little cheaper, you can hire the non-Jew. That's not what we're talking about in the land of Israel. The land of Israel has completely different considerations that you have to look at. And then he says, in such a matter, gadol v'nichbad, like this, you can't rule when you're away. Rav Yochanan Wasserman wasn't in the land of Israel. He even never visited the land of Israel. And he says, only in the abastin, in the land of Israel, you know, the rabbis there who know the pratim, the kol hatzadadim, he says they know the details of what's going on, they can give their decision. And then he has another letter about this. The next page. And he says, again, he says, he caused me, you know, agmat nefesh, he says, agmat nefesh, it caused me pain, you know, it troubled me, distress, that Rabbi Hanuman would do something like this. And he says, I wrote to him and said, why did you send this letter without consulting with me first? And this is something, you know, and he says, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah has decided this is something that should be decided by the rabbis of Israel. And then, the next page. Page 278, there is a letter from Rav Chaim Ozer to the Pole Agudas Yisrael. That's the very same people that Rav Yochanan wrote to. What does he say? Oh, and he's responding to their letter. They get this letter from Yochanan Wasserman. They don't know what to make of this because the Pole Agudas Yisrael were big into this movement that you have to hire only Jews. They're a workers' movement. And it doesn't matter if it's a little too much, a little more money. That's our obligation. We're building up the state. We're in a battle over land between us and the Arabs. You have to do this. And they write to Rabbi Chanan. He says, I received your letter. And he says, regarding the open letter, HaMichtav HaGoloi, that is, this was an open letter sent to Pole Yisrael, but for everyone. He says, I don't know. I didn't know about this before it was sent. And I don't understand why Rabbi Chanan would write this and why he would, spread his private opinion here, and then he says, concerning an important matter like this, we can't decide when we're not in the land of Israel, and again, this is not for the rabbis of Europe to decide. So that's Rabbi Elchanan. Rabbi Chaim Ozer. Rabbi Elchanan replied, and you can read in this book, you know, he wasn't someone to back down, even with criticism. And he replies, and he says, you know, Rabbi Chaim Ozer was saying that you can't decide a question like this unless you're in Israel, unless you see what's going on. So what does he say? Rabbi Chanan says, precisely those who are living in the land of Israel are more apt to be influenced by their surroundings instead of seeing the matter in an objective fashion. I find this an astounding argument. The whole idea of Pesach is you have to know the Metzius, you have to be there on the scene, which is exactly what Rabbi Chaim Ozer says and what the Chazon Ish thought, and Reuven says, and Rav Yochanan turns it around. He's saying that the people in the land of Israel are brainwashed, basically, by what they see the Zionists doing, and they can't analyze it in an objective fashion. But since when does objective mean that you have to be removed from the scene? But that's what he says. Now, Rav Reuven writes to Rav Yochanan also. And let me read you what he says. He begins his letter, B'mechilas kvod Torato, with all apologies to you. He says, you have exaggerated or distorted, the matter is not in accordance with the halakha. And then he says, Upashut hu midnesha rachakum min hamakom. He's saying the reason you were so wrong in what you wrote, Rabbi Chanan, is precisely because you're not on the scene. You're far away. If you remember when we spoke about the Austrit issue, you know, separating from the non-Orthodox communities, when Rav Chaim Ozer was asked this question, he said that this is not something that rabbis outside of Germany can answer. And that's why when they had the dispute between Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and Zelman Meir Bamberger, they never asked Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan Spector, they never asked the Netziv or anyone like that, because this is a sort of thing that unless you're on the scene, you can't make these decisions. You know, we can't ask rabbis from far away. And then Rav Reuven says to him, and you do not know the how things are working in the land of Israel and the situation of the orchards. And then he says, I'm going to explain it to you. And then after explaining to him and dealing with halacha, he ends that if we do not ensure that Jews hire Jews, because the Arabs are not hiring Jews, the Arabs are hiring Arabs, so if the Jews hire Arabs, then he says it'll be no less than that Jewish farmers will, Jews who want to work the fields will starve, literally starve. And there was starvation in the land of Israel, not at this time, but in World War I, you had Jews who starved to death. The story is, I don't know if it's true, I mentioned this when I did with C.P. Frank, that in one of his daughters died. I asked his grandson, who lives in my town, Dr. David Lando, and he says he doesn't know if it's true, although that's what they say, but there were other people who starved. And there was a great dispute between Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rabbi Diskin, because Rabbi Diskin had this orphanage, not the founder of it, his son. When people were starving, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank said, you know, there are great Torah scholars who need food, and he refused to give up food. He says, I need it for the orphanage. And because of that, we're told that some important Torah scholars, not names that we know today, but in Jerusalem, actually literally starved to death. And Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank never forgave Rabbi Diskin. That was Yitzchak Ruchem Diskin. And he said that someone like Rabbi Diskin who doesn't feel the pain of Torah scholars is not deserving of being a rabbi. Of course, I mean, on the other hand, Rabbi Diskin was head of an orphanage and he had this money, and the money from his standpoint was designed for the orphans. And so the orphans are supposed to starve to death? I don't know how Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank could, unless you assume that the Torah scholars are more important than orphans. I don't want to make that judgment, but that's the true story there. But C.P.S. Frank said, since he did not know the pain of great Torah scholars, it showed that he wasn't an Erech Chayid, if you want to use the Yiddish. And there were great disputes in later years between the two. Now, Rav Reuven's position was always middle of the road, as we've seen. Another example, in 1937, he went to the Marienbad Aguda Convention. Rav Chaim Ozer wanted him to go there, and he advocates acceptance of the state. Acceptance of the state, there was this big discussion there in Marienbad, should there be a state? Okay, I see some freezing breaking up. It could be, by the way, if you're wireless, it could break up, but... so far, we hear from others that it's okay. So it could just be your computer. So in Marienbad, they had this big debate. And you can actually go on in the journal Hapardes on HebrewBooks.org. They published the entire proceedings, basically, in abridged form of the convention, which came to a conclusion that they will accept this state, which made sense because the state was going to exist whether the Aguda said anything or not, and if what were they going to do? Be totally separate from it? Then they wouldn't have any involvement and any influence on it. And yet Rabbi Chanan Wasserman opposed recognition and support of a state, and the Aguda as a whole, though, accepted it. Rav Reuven also joined with Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank in opposing any separatist kehila or shchita anywhere in the land of Israel. This was a big issue, because the Aguda in the land of Israel was much more extreme than in Europe. In fact, when what led to the breakup of Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel was when all these people from Poland, in particular Gera Hasidim and others, came to Eretz Yisrael, and they saw what was going on there, and you had German Jews as well, and the Aguda in Israel were opposed to all secular studies. they were opposed to being involved in the larger community. Well, everyone in Poland was a member of a community that included religious and non-religious. That's how the Kielce functioned. They couldn't get along with this tiny extreme element in Jerusalem, and that led to the breakup. But before that, before the real immigration, the extremists, the Eda Haridit, insisted on having a separate community with a separate shrita. And we saw in the classes on Ratzif Pesach Frank how he tried to shut them down. Rav Reuven agreed with him. You cannot have a separate so-called super pious shrita. Today, we have we have a million hashkachas and a million shritas because we don't have kehilas. But in a traditional kehila in Europe, you had one rav and one beis din, and no one could open up their own shul without permission, and no one could open up their own shrita. Anyone who tried to open up their own shrita was immediately, shrita was immediately declared unkosher. And if you recall from last semester, was it two semesters ago, with Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, when the more frum group in London opened up their own shrita, they actually got Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan to ban the shrita of what today we would call the Haredi element. But they weren't just Haredim; they were Shomer Shabbos. Most of the London so-called Orthodox Jews are not even Shomer Shabbos, and yet Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan said, we cannot have separate shlitas. Every community has one shlita, one rav, one beis din, etc. So Rav Reuven agreed with Rav Pesach in that as well. In 1935, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who we will have classes on him, he's the Lindenbaum family, the well-known philanthropist in New York, the Lindenbaum family. They are descended from Rav Amiel. He becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he had an interesting idea. That he was a student of Rav Chaim Ozer, also from that kibbutz I spoke about in Vilna. But he was Mizrahi. Not just was he Mizrahi, he was one of the leading Mizrahiites. Also a Telzer and a great Torah scholar in Talmudic analysis. He wrote a book called Hamidot L'Cheker HaLacha. He had the idea to create something called Machon L'Mishpat HaTorah, in which, since it was obvious that there was going to be a state of Israel, it was coming. They didn't know when it was going to be coming, but it was going to be coming. Without the Irgun, it probably would have come in the 60s, the same time that Britain withdrew from all the African countries. But he, in this machon he wanted to create, the idea was that rabbis and lawyers would work together to draw up a legal system for the new state. I guess that's the best way to put it. Because you need to have people, rabbis, who understand, modern legal thinking, etc. And he got the approval, that is, Rav Amiel had the approval for this of Rav Herzog, who wrote it himself, he wrote a proposed constitution, as we saw, Rav Karlap, and Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. So you can't really get much better bona fides than these. And yet Rav Reuven, showing that you can't predict where he's going to go, he opposes it. And he writes a very strong letter to Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski. And as he explains, this would even be worse than the rabbinical seminary of Berlin coming to the land of Israel. Because what's the rabbinical seminary of Berlin? It's simply a seminary which is more modern, and it's understood that these students at the seminary would also go to the university. But here, what Rav Amiel wanted to do is he wanted to create something in which yeshiva students from all over would become part of it. It would lead to academic studies of the best and the brightest in all the yeshivas. And it's not just a seminary where people are in this one institution. This was designed for the best and the brightest yeshiva students to also, learn things about modern legal systems, etc., for the coming new state. And Rav Reuven says what you're doing then is telling the yeshivas that, academic studies are now going to be part of the curriculum, a university program, as it were, for rabbis. And he was very opposed to that. As we've seen, he thought the yeshivas must remain yeshivas in their pure sense, which is the Volozhin tradition. And nothing ever came from Rav Amiel's idea. He also tells us, by the way, Rav Reuven, that Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer was opposed to it. But I think, when Rav Chaim Ozer gets involved, he was so influential that that would lead to people to abandoning these plans. Now, so much... enough of his biography. Let's talk a little bit about some of the works. Now, in the previous classes we've done, and most of the speakers, we spend a good deal of time about their responsa, those who wrote responsa, different halachic decisions, interesting ones, unique ones. With Rav Reuven, I can't really speak about halacha. That's even though he published three volumes of responsa called Degel Reuven, because if you look in his responsa, in fact, I don't even know of one shitav, one unusual view, one interesting view, at all, of Rav Reuven Katz. If you look in the three volumes of his responsa, they're not responsa. They're called Sheol Teshuvot, but they're not. First of all, Sheol Teshuvot, it means, implies that you're responding to someone else. For the most part, he wasn't responding. And second of all, they're not halachic. They're simply analysis. And even when he is responding, these are all theoretical discussions. So normally when we think of response, we think of actual halacha. In the first volume, if I'm not mistaken, there's only one practical halachic decision. So when we think of halacha, this is not what we think of. These are Talmudic. I'm sure they're quite brilliant, as I mentioned already, that after the first volume appeared, there was a lot of excitement in the yeshiva world. So those of you who are studying traditional Talmud study, you can examine his theoretical analyses of different things. But it's not going to get us practical halacha. However, in skimming through it, this is years ago, when I first discovered the volume, many years ago, and if you look in my studies in Maimonides, my little book, I mention the Degel Reuven because I'm skimming through it, and what do I come across? I come across an amazing passage, just by accident. And let me read it to you in Hebrew, and then explain why I thought it so important, why I quoted it in my book, and there's even it relates to a tradition there of Soloveitchik quoted. I'll read it in Hebrew first, for those of you who know Hebrew. He's quoting, this is volume 3, number 38. He's talking about an issue, a dispute, a conflict in the Rambam. A difficulty in the Rambam. As we say, a shver Rambam, a difficult Rambam. And he quotes the Rambam, who was asked this about this difficulty, by the sages of southern France, of Lunel. And the Rambam has a series of letters explaining his positions. And these letters are, let me tell you what Rav Soloveitchik said right now. He said that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, his grandfather, quote, didn't like these responses. Why didn't he like these responses? Because the Rambam doesn't give any, you know, Talmudic analysis of the brisker sort. You know, when he's asked questions, difficulties, he gives simple answers. Some places he says there's a mistake in the text. I changed my mind, that sort of thing. And what does the Degel Reuven say? Quote, Efshar lataritz divrei haRambam b'halacha. We can answer this difficulty in the Rambam. Lo kemosha mataritz l'chachmei Lunel. Not in accordance with how he explains it to the sages of Lunel. El kafi perish b'perish mishnayos. But based on something he explains in the perish of Mishnah. What is he saying here? Even though the Rambam explained what the meaning of the passage is, nevertheless, Rav Reuven says, we can offer a better explanation. He doesn't say better, he says, we can offer a different explanation. What does that mean? If the Rambam tells you what he meant, the sages of Lunel asked him a question, this doesn't make sense, Rambam, it seems to contradict the Talmud, and the Rambam says, no, this is what I mean. How do you go about giving a different answer to explain the Rambam than the Rambam did? Well, if you look in my book, you'll see that there's a whole tradition of doing this. That even the Chasam Sofer said that when the Rambam is reported as saying, that when the Rambam wrote his responsa to Lunel, he was not the Rambam. That is, he did not have the same level of divine assistance and everything. So therefore, there's a whole tradition of people, scholars, great Torah scholars, who, despite the fact that the Rambam explains himself, think that they will explain him differently, even better. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik offers an explanation in one of his famous commentaries on the Rambam, different than the Rambam himself explains his words. And we know that Reb Chaim knew what the Rambam said because it's quoted in the Kesef Mishnah. And yet Reb Chaim ignores what the Rambam himself writes and gives a different explanation, one that he thinks is a better explanation. It's very postmodern. You know, in postmodern thinking, we like to say that authors are not, to use the Yiddish expression, an author is not a balabas over his own writing. That is, if we have a piece of work by Shakespeare, that now that it's been put out into the world, it's for everyone to analyze it and everyone to explain it. The author does not have exclusive rights over his or her own work to give the absolute final explanation. That you know, there's all sorts of truths that are latent in it, and even an author doesn't understand everything that's in the work. But we do not give authors exclusive rights in how to explain what they meant. And we see this in how people approach the Rambam. that they routinely, a number of people routinely feel that it's okay to explain the Rambam differently than the Rambam explains himself. This relates, I think, to another idea that when it comes to, not just in explaining the Rambam, but when it comes to halacha, we can also follow the Rambam, what he says in the Mishnah Torah, not what he says in the Responsa, even if he retracts, because we hold like the Mishnah Torah. That is, the Mishnah Torah has been accepted, not the Rambam. The work itself has been accepted, and if the Rambam, because it's such a brilliant, great work, and if in fact the Rambam himself later changes his mind, it doesn't matter, because it's not the Rambam's authority anymore. It's the Mishnah Torah on its own, which has been accepted. And this isn't just the Rambam, by the way. This is the Shulchan Aruch as well. The Sfaradim, or many Sfaradim, accepted the Shulchan Aruch. Now, in Morocco, the whole Moroccan halachic tradition, which we dealt with when we spoke about Rav Mesas, is that you accept the Shulchan Aruch, but you don't accept Rav Yosef Karo. What does that mean, you accept the Shulchan Aruch, you don't accept Rav Yosef Karo? Well, Rav Yosef Karo has a few other writings. First of all, he has his responsa, the Avkat Rachel. But more importantly, he has something called the Bedek Abayit. The Shulchan Aruch is an abridgment of the Beit Yosef. However, there's also something called the Bedek Abayit, in which the Beit Yosef added things on. So what happens if you have the halacha in the Beit Yosef, which is then recorded in the Shulchan Aruch, but then the Shulchan Maran, Rav Yosef Karo, changes his mind, retracts in the Beit Yosef, in the Bedek Abayit, or in his responsa? The halachic tradition in all of Morocco was that we only accepted the Shulchan Aruch to bind us. We didn't accept anything else. And therefore, and by the way, so if it's not like we rely on Rav Yosef Karo. The Shulchan Aruch is, he didn't make anything up. He's using two of the three, usually, of the great rabbis, the Rush, the Riff, and the Rambam. And therefore, just because he changes his mind later on, we still hold like the Shulchan Aruch. It's not like we're holding by no one. We're still holding by the original opinions. There was a, I can't remember who it is. I forget now who it is, but some rabbi attacked the Moroccans for saying, "How can you say such a thing that you accept the work, the book, but you don't accept the man?" And they replied to Rav Mamon, he's one of the elder Moroccan rabbis, replied that no, that's exactly the case, that we accept the work, not the author. The work was thought to be brilliant and was thought to to be divinely inspired, etc., etc., and therefore that's what we accept. But we don't accept the author, and the author does not even therefore have the right to make us change our opinion because we accept the work, not the author. And I think as well that has postmodern implications, that the work is independent of the author. Let me talk a little bit about some halachic matters, though, or quasi-halachic matters, that he didn't write responsibly dealt with it. And Reuven Katz at the beginning of the state, and one who thought that the state is an important thing, we need to do our utmost to bring it in line with halachic values. He wrote about this, a number of essays, and one of the things he had dealt with was, we're going to have a government, there's going to be a parliament, there'll be positions of authority. There's this halacha that in a Jewish state, all you have to do is look in the Rambam and elsewhere, non-Jews are not to be given positions of authority. We call srara. That word is, I don't know how to translate it. Classically, it means like rulership or authority positions. It's an important word to know because this gets into the whole debate about women being presidents of synagogues because the Rambam talks about how women shouldn't be in positions of srara. Now, where does he get this is a problem because the Sifrei speaks, which is where it derives from, speaks about the Sifrei as we have it, and the Gemaras, they don't speak about all positions, they speak about kingship. The Rambam quotes the Sifrei, or derives from the Sifrei, that it's all positions of authority. It turns out that we found in the Geniza texts of the Sifrei that do say that that all positions of authority, srara, should not be for women, and for many centuries, people were wondering where the Rambam got this, and people rejected the Rambam because they said there's no source for this. It is a source. He didn't derive it on his own. But so what does srara mean? Well, as I said, it's a position of authority, and we know that a non-Jew in the Jewish state is not supposed to have a position of authority. But then how can you have a democratic state? By definition, a democratic state, anyone can get elected. So Rav Ruvain deals with this. We're going to have a state. We have a state. He wrote this essay after the state. It's in the Shaar Ruvain, which I showed you. Here's the Shaar Ruvain. I have my copy here. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it printed from HebrewBooks.org. If most books that are old, if they'll print it for you, they look like this. But more recent books, they won't print. Even if you tell them that the family doesn't care, because they say they need 75 years before copyright is done. So I just made a PDF of it, and there's a million places online who will print it and bind it very cheaply. The problem is I don't have the software or whatever I need on my computer to turn a PDF around, so it reads the wrong direction. But that's okay. I'm able to sit and read it, and it's a long book. It's over 300 pages. So in Shaar Ruvain, beginning page 45, he discusses this problem, and he says something which I don't think is correct. But it gives him the legal fiction that it's okay for the state of Israel to appoint Arabs or non-Jews in general to positions of authority in government. And it gives him the legal fiction to show that the state is not in conflict with democracy. What does he say? He says, tell me if I'm wrong, if you disagree, but I don't think he's right. And, you tell me. He says that, yes, we cannot appoint Arabs. You know, because non-Jews are not supposed to have positions of authority in the Torah state. But he says that when we appoint an Arab, he's really only appointed for the Arab community, based on their rights as a minority. The Arabs need to have spokesmen as well. But it isn't feasible to have a situation where you have ministers for Jews and ministers for non-Jews. As you can't have, a minister of agriculture, if they have that in Israel, you know, one minister of agriculture for the Jews and one for the non-Jews. And truthfully, there weren't any ministers who were Arabs in those days, but you had positions in government, you know, vice minister or something. They gave him these secondary type positions, which also he's assuming would be a problem. But he's saying that even if they'd be given the ultimate authority, ministers, they're really only being appointed to represent their group. However, logistically, we can't do this. And therefore, because you can't have two ministers of interior, two ministers of that. But the only reason we're appointing them is because they're Arabs in the country. And therefore, they really just represent the Arabs. And to make matters easier, we'll also let them take care of the Jews. On the one hand, it is true. If there weren't any Arabs, they wouldn't be appointed. But can you really say that they're only being appointed to represent the Arabs? No, in a democracy, they're being appointed to represent everyone. But that's what he says. And they have functions that affect the Jews, but that's not why they're being appointed. But in any event, he says, therefore, there's no conflict with the idea that the an appointee in the Jewish government has to come mikerev achicha, you know, among your brothers. Now, Rav Herzog dealt with this also in his proposed constitution. He didn't think there was any problem at all, simply because, according to Rav Herzog, the definition of srara is a position that passes by Yerusha, a position that passes, you know, from father to son or son-in-law or something like that. That's the definition. Like a king, according to some, like a rabbi. Yeah, but all these positions are temporary positions. According to Rav Herzog, there's no sarara at all whatsoever in any synagogue position. There's no sarara in any elected position. It's just unique for kingship. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, great, great Torah scholar, also very much involved in the Zionist enterprise, who will have classes on him, he said that quite apart from that, by definition, Sarara cannot be temporary. Sarara is, by definition, a permanent position, a position that comes today and gone tomorrow, as all positions in democratic countries are, is not Sarara. And it is simply, what is his role or her role? It is that of a shaliach of the community, a representative of the community that serves at the behest of the community. I think from a pure halachic standpoint, I do believe that the Haredim accept this as well, that they don't think that these are sarara positions, and that the reason why they don't allow women to serve in any of these positions is because of tznius reasons. In fact, if you look at the Haredi polemics against women in government, they never mention Sororo. At least I haven't seen it. It's always Sneos. Because it's very hard to make the case that any of these things have to do anything to do with Sororo. There are people who make the case as for Schachter, who mentioned one about women presidents and things like that, so of shuls. But supposedly Soloveitchik felt that way, but it's hard to see how it could be Sorora, because in most shuls, or many shuls, the president doesn't even have the authority to write a check. You know, this is something that has to be through the board, so I'm not sure, I don't understand the Sorora element. So Shlomo, who, if he says Rav Moshe, there's what to rely on being his family connection, but I don't know. Where does Rav Moshe say that, Shlomo? I mean, he says that in Igros Moshe. I don't recall him saying it in Igros Moshe. His famous tshuva deals with the women mashkichim. You talk about the tshuva dealing with the female mashkichot? Is that the tshuva you're talking about? Where he deals with it? Yeah, but, okay. Okay, let me look at the tshuva again before I comment, because I know the tshuva, and I, my recollection is that, I don't know how, well, let me just wait, I'll look at it for next class, because I seem to recall not really being Sorora in the in a pure halachic sense, but let me look at it again for next class. But even if that's the case, I still would have the question on Rav Moshe. Because I do know that the presidents that we have, by the way, in the local Jewish school here, we've had a woman principal, we've had a woman president. I mean, what does the president do? The president sits in front of the meeting and calls it to order. The president doesn't have any more authority than anyone else there. I mean, you have board members who are women. No one has an issue with that. All the president does is the president doesn't have 10 votes. It's not like Obama, who the cabinet could take a vote and 10 to nothing, and then he could say, well, I disagree, and, you know, his position wins. What does the president do? The president has no authority over the other board members. As I said, he can't even write a check. So I don't know what the Sorora at all, unless you're going to say that anyone on the board, but no one says that. The whole issue is only the president and maybe the vice president, because the vice president could become a president. So I don't understand how this relates to, because this isn't even like president of a country or governor or mayor. This is nothing. It's just someone who reads the announcements on Shabbos and is first among equals. How could you have Sorora if you're first among equals? The definition of Sorora is that you're above someone else. So I don't understand it. But I'll take a look at Rav Moshe. And if it doesn't matter, because for the people who oppose it, you could prove this, it wouldn't matter. It still would be an unsneas thing to have the woman involved. That's it. Okay, Yisrael says the president decides soda or seltzer for Shalosh Shudas. Okay, it could be. Maybe that would be Sorora. Although in my shul, no, we have a Shalosh Shudas and a Kiddush committee. They decide all those things. In the Shaar Reuven, he has a number of essays in which he deals with the state of Israel. And listen to some of his language. If anyone has any doubts about his position in this, he has an essay titled Yom Ha'atzma'ut. This is on page 305. And this is how it begins. This is from 1951. Yom Ha'atzma'ut hu yom shel tefila v'hodaya al ha'nisim v'ha'tshuot shenasu lanu. Thank God that we've reached this wonderful day for Yom Ha'atzma'ut. It's this wonderful day we give blessing and thanks for the miracles. And then he says, goes on and on, that thank God for establishing this state of ours, etc., etc. I mean, that's very Zionistic. And he is a Zionist of a sort. He calls on page 247, on this page as well, on 247, I'm thinking because I have this book. There's this book I showed you before by Yitzhak Dadon. Two volumes called Atchaltahi, which goes through all the rabbis who were big Zionists. And he includes Reuven, even though he's not such a big Zionist. But on page, this is volume one. Yitzhak Dadon, as I mentioned, is the one that Torah scholar, he's also written the commentary on Rashi and other things. He was the guy on top of Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva when the terrorists came in. and shot all those young men. They were in the actually in the yeshiva at Seirim. He, Yitzhak Dadon, killed the terrorists. That should be reason enough for everyone. Even if you don't go to the army, the Haredim should at least get military training, because who knows what could happen. And he was on the roof, and he had his gun, either on Miloim or whatever. He was learning. You can go on YouTube, and you can watch the interview. Because not only does he tell what happened, at the end he starts attacking Perez I don't know what Perez was at the time. I can't remember. Was he prime minister then? He must have been, or maybe I think he was even, no, I think he was president then. So I don't know why he would attack Perez, but for creating a situation where there could be terrorists. But that's Yitzhak Dadon. And in this, he has a chapter on Rav Reuven Katz, in which he takes from the Shah Reuven, and this is what Rav Reuven Katz says. Doreinu zachal lirot ha'atchalta d'ge'ua. Our generation has been worthy to see the beginning of the redemption. Those words are anathema, as we all know, in the Haredi world, to say that this secular state of Israel could be the beginning of the redemption, not only in the Haredi world, in the Chabad world. The Lubavitcher Rebbe has very, very negative things to say about Atchalta D'Gula. That he says it can't be. Not that we don't know, or we hope, but we're not sure. The Rebbe says it absolutely cannot be the Atchalta D'Gula. And you're obligated to believe in a positive way that it's not the Atchalta D'Gula. And Rav Reuven says it is Atchalta D'Gula. And he does this on numerous occasions. On page 28 in Shar Reuven, in speaking about the state, he says as follows. He says that this great miracle of the state of Israel can only be seen and appreciated after a dorot, that is, in the future. This isn't something that us living through it can really understand and appreciate how significant it is. I asked, I think Shlomo, you'll appreciate this. Years ago, I was a waiter at this establishment in Staten Island called Simcha by the Sea. I've mentioned it before, where all the great rabbis used to come, and once the Feinstein family came for Rav Reuven Feinstein's daughter's Sheva Brachos. Oh, the whole Shabbos I was talking with Rav Reuven Feinstein, I was his waiter, and all sorts of good stories and good things. But Rav Mordechai Tendler was there, and I was he was young, obviously. This would have been in 1984. And Rav Moshe was supposed to come. At least they thought he was going to come. We were told he was coming, and at the end he didn't come. So I asked Rav Mordechai Tendler, why is your grandfather's not such a Zionist? He doesn't appreciate the state of Israel so much. Because we had known that he wasn't so... Rakefa tells the story that when they were in Bnei Akiva in the Bronx, a whole group of them went to see Rav Moshe because they wanted to say halal on Yom HaTzmut, and they heard Rav Moshe was opposed to it. So Rav Moshe said to them, by me, it's not such a chag. But if you think it's a chag, you can say halal. I'm assuming without a bracha. But he said, for me, it's not such a holiday. But if you think it's a holiday, you can say it. So Mordechai Tendler said to me that, this is the sort of thing that people, the older generation doesn't appreciate, the way we do, the younger generation. And I remember, so I went back to high school and I told my Rebbe that that's what Mordechai Tendler said. Oy, what he thought that was unbelievable chutzpah to say that, say that about Reb Moshe. But he said it. Of course, he comes from a more Zionistic, the Tendlers are more Zionistic. Rav Reuven also wrote an essay, which is not included in Shar Reuven. It's included in the journal that was published by YU. YU published an unbelievably good Torah/scholarly journal. There isn't a journal like that today. Well, actually, take that back. Hamayan in Israel might be like it. But Mayan's a small journal. I'm thinking of the journal Talpiot, which is more like an annual. It came out every year, and it was like 400 pages. And take a look on HebrewBooks.org. You can see some of these issues. And everyone wrote for it, all the great rabbis. Rav Reuven has an essay in the third volume in which he deals with Jewish law in the state of Israel. Everyone was talking about this matter, Jewish law in the state of Israel. Some of these rabbis were convinced that the state would actually start adopting halakha. But it was good. You needed to know. Look, the Haredim weren't dealing with this. For them, this is all Aschata de Geula. I mean, not Aschata de Geula, sorry. Take that back. For them, this is all Hilchasa de Mashiach. You know, in Messianic days, we'll have to deal with it. But for those who thought that this was a positive thing, and therefore, if you wanted the state to work in accordance with halacha as much as you can, so it's important to analyze, you know, how does the police force run on Shabbos? How does the parliament run on Shabbos? For the Haredim, then these are just beyond them, these questions. Not just then, today too. When's the last time that a Haredi posted, he can be the most learned in the world, ever dealt with a question like, I mentioned it to one of the listeners the other day, you know, the environment, you know, Jewish views of the environment, halachic views of immigration. I mean, these sorts of topics, which if you believe in a Torah Chaim, a living Torah, you want answers to. So Rav Reuven deals with Jewish law in the state of Israel. And he begins by quoting an unbelievable text by the Vilna Gaon. Those who read my last foreign blog will know this text. It's an amazing text. And I knew it before. Now I know it years ago because I was learning it, and I spoke to Professor Tversky about this passage as well. The Vilna Gaon writes in Aderes Eliyahu that in Eretz Yisrael, non-Jews have to observe Torah and mitzvahs. This is an amazing thing, because who ever heard of such a thing? That non-Jews, Goyim, have to observe Shabbos, have to observe Kashrus, have to observe everything in the land of Israel? And yet the Gaon says it. He doesn't just say it once. I quoted it in my post, how the Tzitz Eliezer thinks this must be a mistake put in by some erring student. But the Tzitz Eliezer only knew it in one place. He repeats it elsewhere in Aderes Eliyahu. Now, there could be mistakes in Aderes Eliyahu because it was put together by students, but twice? And he doesn't just say it, he explains it. There's a verse in 2 Kings, chapter 17, verse 26, that speaks of the non-Jews being punished by God because Einam Yodim et Mishpat Olei Haaretz. They don't know, you know, the halachas of the land. And that's what the Gra says. And the Gra is quoted by a number of people. Everyone tries to figure out what he means by that, but he's quoted. And you can't just take a text and say it's a mistake because it's a strange passage. Rav Reuven, he quotes it as well. And he thinks that this will enable us to understand how non-Jews should live in the land of Israel. Now, he thinks, his understanding is that it only relates to monetary matters. That is, that non-Jews in Israel, in public things such as, you know, Chosh and Mishpat type of things, they have to go in accordance with Jewish law. The problem is that if you look at the Gra in context, he doesn't seem to be saying this. Everyone understands him, and this is, other than Rav Reuven, and this is what he's saying, that they're obligated in all laws. It's precisely that radical idea that leads the Tzitz Eliezer to say, it must be a mistake. I see it's, you know, we need to get into this, so let me stop now and take some questions. I just have maybe another 15 minutes left of Rav Reuven, 20 minutes left, so we definitely will pick up next class with the Ben Ish Chai. We'll start with the Ben Ish Chai, but we still have maybe about 15, 20 more minutes of Rav Reuven, including some interesting things. I'm sure you'll find it interesting. Actually, let me take that back. I'm sure we'll get to the Ben Ish Chai next class, but I see I have about 7 pages of notes, so maybe a little more. But this is a whole issue, so I don't want to get into it. We've seen in the past numerous examples of these unusual opinions, which rabbis typically claim, well, it must be a mistaken text. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein is famous for over and over again declaring that texts that don't agree with his understanding are problematic or inauthentic texts, which is not scientific. And if a text has been studied for 1,000 years or 2,000 years in some cases, we have to assume that it's authentic. But with newly discovered texts, then it's, you have that. The famous example is Rabbi Soloveitchik, where Lieberman told him that they found this text in the Geniza. I think it was the Dead Sea Scrolls, actually, although it's recorded often as being in the Geniza, but I think it's from the Dead Sea Scrolls that talks about a Kohen. We know that a Kohen can't come into contact with a dead body, and this text records a Kohen is Muzhar al Asheretz, like a creepy crawly thing, you know, Kohen can't come into contact with. And the Rav asked Lieberman, do you take this seriously? And Lieberman said, yes. From Lieberman's standpoint, this was a different tradition, you know, a more machmir tradition, which was not accepted, that Kohenim also have to avoid, you know, dead animals or things like that, not just people. And the Rav said, no, The Rav asked Lieberman, the way the story goes, the Rav asked Lieberman, because he knew that the Lieberman, the certain Talmudic scholar Lieberman, didn't think anything of him. And in the way the story is recorded, and the Rav himself didn't say who he mentioned, but I think it's obvious he's referring to Bielobrotsky, because I know Lieberman didn't think highly of him, or it could have been. There are some others. I don't need to get into the names. So he asks him, what do you think about so-and-so? And Lieberman says, he's an Amoritz. So the Rav says, what, you think there was only Amoratzim in modern times? There's only Amoratzim today? So you had an Amoritz 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago, it's Dead Sea Scroll, and the Amoritz wrote down his Chiddush. About that, just because an Amoritz writes down a Chiddush doesn't mean that, it's tradition and we need to take it seriously. And then the Rav explained, this is the talk he gave, where he says that the practitioners of academic Jewish scholarship, they speak in terms of traditions, different traditions. The truth of the matter is, I'm sympathetic to Lieberman, because we do know about traditions. Just today, I was emailing back and forth with someone about, you have in Targum, what they call Pseudo-Jonathan, you have a passage there which goes against what the Talmud says. And that, by the way, shows you that this is an ancient Targum, because if this Targum... it wasn't written by Jonathan Ben Raziel, but it wasn't, even though there's references in there, there's a reference in the Targum Jonathan to the daughter and the wife of the wife and daughter of Muhammad. There's a reference to Constantinople. So clearly we're talking about a Targum that's written a lot after Jonathan Ben Raziel or even after any, Talmudic sage. Yet those are only interpolations. We know it's an early Targum, because you have things in there, two things in particular, which go against the Talmudic halacha. No Targum that was composed in the 8th century, the 9th century, the 10th century, would ever include anything in it against halacha. However, if the Targum is still preserving a tradition that existed during Mishnaic days, when these opinions were regarded as valid opinions, that is, before the halacha had been decided, then there's no problem. That's how you can see that this is an old Targum. So these are traditions. We have traditions. I mean, even Ayin Tachat Ayin. The Rambam says no one ever interpreted Ayin Tachat Ayin literally, but look in the Gemara. There's an opinion that certainly does seem to interpret it as having been literal. And the list goes on. So let me take some questions. Thank you all who came out tonight. This was a nice class. Yisrael asks, how is he not a religious Zionist if he believes the state is the beginning of redemption? What is a Zionist? So, I said he is a Zionist. However, he doesn't believe that the state has messianic implications. That's the first thing. And second of all, he doesn't think that the state has religious implications, in that we start changing words of prayers and all that. So, yes, the creation of the state is a gift from God. So in that sense, he's a Zionist. But in the idea that all of a sudden now that our Judaism is sort of different because we're in the land of Israel and the state itself has religious significance other than the creation, that he doesn't see, because as long as the state is not functioning in accordance with Torah, then it's a secular state. So the creation of the state is a great miracle and it's a wonderful thing. But since the state is not practicing in accordance with Torah, it's basically giving up its ability to continue with this great Kiddush Hashem, the creation of the state. So in that sense, I said, he's not such a Zionist because the state at present doesn't have real religious significance. And you don't say the prayer for the state without, all that, all these things. But it had, and it could still have. So in that sense, so I don't know what you call that. He's a religious Zionist. He believes there should be a state. It's a Tchalta de Geula, but the state at present doesn't have significance in a religious sense. Now, most religious Zionists, their attitude is that even though the state's not religious, the state nevertheless is holy, the state has significance. He's sort of sui generis, Reuven Katz. Most religious Zionists, either you're a religious Zionist and you see the religious significance in the state, or you're a Haredi and you see no religious significance and you don't care about the creation of the state. Reuven Katz, you saw the rhetoric of how important the state is, but because the state is not functioning Torah-wise, then he backs away. There were, by the way, a number of people, Haredi types, Yeshiva Chevron types, who who had similar feelings when the state was created. What a great miracle. But since the state then did not choose to function in a Torah manner, they sort of backed off. I think that's how you have to look at Reuven Katz. Next question. Chaim says that Rav Zevulun Charlap insisted from personal conversation with Rav Moshe that Rav Moshe was a Zionist but didn't make it public to remain to maintain his standing in the Haredi community. Okay, it's interesting, and we have a member of the family who could perhaps comment. And from we did the classes on Rav Moshe, I don't see any evidence of that publicly. Now, it is true that sometimes people don't speak publicly. I have a document that was published, which I can send to everyone, put out by the extremists in Israel attacking Rabbi Steinman, who, although in recent weeks he's also had extreme rhetoric for years, he's been very moderate. And one of the religious Zionist rabbis, who's a student of his, claims that Rav Steinman told him, and this is quoted to attack Rav Steinman, that really he's very moderate, Rav Steinman says, and he has all sorts of things he wants to do. But if he's public and open about it, the Askanim will throw him out, and therefore he won't be able to accomplish anything. So he has to work quietly. And I don't know, what did Rav Moshe say? I mean, he met with Menachem Begin. He wrote letters. He was on good terms with religious Zionist rabbis, and he wrote public things that related to the state, you know, the state of Israel, and he spoke about Entebbe raid and that sort of thing. But he never expressed, he was a member of Agudas Yisrael, he never expressed religious Zionist sentiment. Remember what religious Zionism means. Religious Zionism means that you work together with the non-religious to create a state. And you respect the contribution of the non-religious, even if you disagree with them. I mean, Rav Moshe has that letter which he writes to the Bnei Akiva, Nativ Meir students, about how the army is important, but, you know, learning Torah is more important at this stage in your life. So in that sense, yes, he doesn't attack the army. He expresses the value of the army, but he wasn't an extremist at all. But if you have to put him, I wouldn't call him a Zionist. He's in the middle. And he did say to Rakefet, for me, it's not such a chag. Shlomo says, why do I think Rav Chaim Ozer not liking that Rav Chanan had opinion other than what the Moetzes opinion would be? If you read Rav Chaim Ozer's letter, what he's saying is, first of all, that the real issue was that this is something for the rabbis of the land of Israel. And then he says, in addition, he puts in one of the letters, he says that, you know, this is like a national thing, and the Moetzes HaGedolei HaTorah, he says, you know, there has said, I don't have the letter here, but this is something for the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael. So it's not that the Moetzes HaGedolei HaTorah made a decision, it's that the rabbis, Moetzes HaGedolei HaTorah, their viewpoint is that this is something that should be decided by the rabbis of the land of Israel. But that's the real issue, that it's not something for rabbis in the Galut to decide. That's what I think is, he's not saying that Rav Chanan, if this is a local matter, Rav Chanan needs to listen to the Moetzes HaGedolei HaTorah. The Moetzes HaGedolei HaTorah is just the thing he's saying that, I don't know Rav Chanan did this, and the Moetzes said that this should be something that the Beis Din in Israel should do, so why is Rav Chanan on his own doing something like that? That's what I think it is. Now, and you said, why would Rav Chaim Ozer not like what Rav Chanan wrote if he would have been asked? How was any different in his own letter regarding the Berlin Seminary? Okay, that's an excellent question, Shlomo. Why does Rav Chaim Ozer get involved then with the Berlin Seminary? Leave it to the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael. It's their job to be involved with it. Good question. I think maybe you get an insight into it in Rav Chaim Ozer's letter. He says to them, he's in Europe, and he's saying, we know what German culture did. But you're still, it could be it's an inconsistency there. Why not let the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael decide? Had Rav Chaim Ozer not intervened, the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary would have moved to the land of Israel. Because other than Reuven Katz, there was no real opposition to it. Rav Kook agreed, as long as it's not in Jerusalem. So I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. That's a good point. Bill says, the text is from the Gaonim. It happened at Dr. Hyman's son's bris. Well, that's how it's recorded. And I knew it happened at his bris because I heard that from Dr. Hyman's son himself, if I recall. Rav Schechter doesn't mention, I don't think, Dr. Hyman, does he? But I'm doing this from memory now. I'll check for next week. Shama Friedman wrote an essay, and it was published, and I have a copy of it. A couple years ago, in the Lieberman-Yortzeit lecture, in which he deals with it, I think I sent that to you, Bill. Doesn't he mention there the Dead Sea Scrolls, not the Gaonim? I'll check it. Definitely Rav Schechter and Rakef and everyone who cites it refers to a text from the Geniza, but my recollection seems to be that in Shama's article, he mentions the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'll get the details for you next week on that. Or if anyone has the essay, I sent it to a few people. Dr. Hyman, let me explain for those who don't know, Arthur Hyman, he should live and be well. People don't realize this. He's a musmach of JTS, his Masada Kedushin. I saw it at his house. A picture of it was Louis Finkelstein. He always had good relations with people like Lieberman. Then he goes to Harvard. He becomes he's a student of Wolfson, PhD, and then he goes to YU. The Rav asked Wolfson who should teach philosophy, and he said Hyman. And Hyman's been there for decades and decades. As Arthur Hyman told me himself, today he doesn't think they'd hire someone with a JTS smicha. Let me make a note of this, so I'll get it for you next class. Did the Rav speak about... okay, next question. Yisrael asks, why can't the state be the beginning of the redemption according to Lubavitcher Rebbe? It can't be this beginning because he says it doesn't go in accordance with the Rambam's prescriptions. If you look in Rambam, Hilchot Malachim, of how the Messianic era is supposed to happen, it doesn't work like this. And not only the Lubavitcher Rebbe, makes it all halachic, but the typical Haredi view is also it can't be because by definition they assume that if the non-religious secularists are responsible for this, then it can't be. And how could it be the Etchal Tegula when you're forcing soldiers and Jews to go to the army, etc.? On the other hand, you have texts that show differently. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe has essays on this. He has lectures on it. Not only that, this is something people don't realize. Hard to hear, but it's the truth. The Rebbe speaks in one of his Likutei Sichot about how, you know, the deaths in Israel in the wars are due to this idea that they've accepted that this is Etchal Tegula. That this is, I'm not sure whether he means it's a punishment from God or because that they think it's a Zechal Tegula, that this sort of leads them into wars that they shouldn't be involved in. But he says there, now in one of the volumes that discusses this from the Chabad person, he points out that the Rebbe only said this like once or twice. This wasn't a major theme of his, but he does say that this idea that the, you know, it's a Zechal Tegula is responsible for, leading to deaths in the state of Israel. He's not the only one. Remember years ago at the Meir Kazirav massacre when you had that, I don't like to call him rabbi, he came to America, one of the leading Haredi ideologues. The students had just been killed. It was, I think, the second day. The parents are still sitting shiva. And this modern-day prophet gets up and declares that why were the Meir Kazirav boys killed? Because of Zionism. You know, he has a direct line to God, and He can declare. I mean, it's bad enough to say something like that, to say something during Shiva. I mean, it's unbelievable, these people, that they think that they know God's workings. And it's Zionism. That's why. Yisrael says, regarding Reb Chaim Ozer in the seminary, maybe it's because it was a European institution moving to Israel, and he knew the institution. Okay, that could be that he knew the institution, but... you know, the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, Rav Kook was not, he knew what's going on in Europe. He had been to Europe. You could make a case that it's inconsistent. The difference is that Rav Chaim Ozer thought this was crucial. When it came to the Avodah Ivrit, he didn't accept Rav Hanan's opinion. When it came to the seminary, he thought that that would destroy the yeshivas in Israel. Okay, Bill, email me. I said, okay, thank you all. You don't need to email me, Bill. You're the last comment. Oh, one more comment. When you say they starved in Israel, do you mean they got weak and caught an illness, or they literally withered away to skin and bones like in the concentration camps? I don't know. The texts say they starved. I think that's all the same thing. If you're not getting any food and you're withering away, you catch all sorts of illnesses and diseases. Palestine, during World War I, there literally was not food for people. and people literally starve to death. Even when we say people starve to death, it doesn't mean it's like they're on the respirator and we literally don't give them any food. And when you become weak like that, you're subject to all sorts of illnesses and everything. So I don't know. But as I said, there were people who starved in the land of Israel. Hey, good night, everyone. Thank you all for coming tonight.